What we're trying to say is that differentiation through packaging is table stakes. The same way that everything else in the advertising and branding landscape is table stakes these days, right? No one thing gets it done anymore. You have to be amazing at everything.
I'm your host, Dave Knox, and this is Predicting the Turn, a show that helps business leaders meet their industry's inevitable disruption head on.
Welcome to another episode of Predicting the Turn. Today, we sit down with Andrew Bannon, who is the CEO and founder of Graza. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave. Excited to be here.
Awesome. Well, it's a pleasure to meet you. I want to go back to the very beginning and the story of Graza. What led you to launch the brand in 2022?
Oh, man. I mean, there's a confluence of a lot of factors coming together. I think everyone in my world has their own version of a food journey. Somewhat, whether it's via health, cooking. For me, actually, prior to Graza, it was obsessing with nutrition. I'm just trying to figure out what was going on in the nutritional agenda in the United States. And I actually got into grad school at Tufts in Boston to focus on nutrition. Didn't get the scholarship that I wanted and pivoted back into the private sector, joining Magic Spoon. After that experience, working at the New York City Green Market System, the local farmers market. And then, as so happens in New York, fell in love with my wife, who's from Spain. And there's a lot of great olive oil in Spain. Got lucky enough to try an amazing bottle when I was out visiting her family and meeting them for the first time. And an obsession began, true obsession. It came way before sizzle, way before drizzle, way before everything. And yeah, olive oil is an interesting category because it has 50% plus household penetration. And in the world of starting companies and advertising, targeting niches of sorts, this one felt like a new challenge because it was so expansive, so saturated, so commonplace. So I don't know, it was an obsession with a big opportunity.
So with that obsession, one of the things that consumers have become obsessed with is the amazing packaging that you guys have had since day one. Yeah. What led that to an insight that you decided to tackle that when you went after the product?
It's funny because I cooked in the line at Gramercy Tavern where we're using squeeze bottles both for cooking and for finishing. And I wish I had remembered that when I was starting Graza because it came much later. I think people call it chaos packaging now, and that term actually rubs me the wrong way because I think what we're trying to say is that differentiation through packaging is table stakes. The same way that everything else in the advertising and branding landscape is table stakes these days. Right? No one thing gets it done anymore. You have to be amazing at everything. The squeeze bottle inspiration for me came from using a Dr. Bronner's bottle in the shower and running out of the bathroom extremely sudsy because Dr. Bronner's, for some reason, takes forever to wash off. But I compromised on the amount of suds and ran straight out to the kitchen, washed it out and filled it up with olive oil and started squeezing it into a pan and feeling like we had just discovered a new tactile experience in the kitchen. It wasn't about olive oil. It wasn't about a squeeze bottle. And it wasn't about a brand that was going to be built. It was about a feeling, literally the act of squeezing. Felt more empowering and that there could be a story and a movement behind it for this space, for cooking as a whole.
You've come from that amazing background thinking about the spaces and you've been part of really fast-growing brands in the consumer space. When you launched Graza, what did you want to do differently to go off and grow this brand and create it?
I think we were coming out of a generation that was rooted in growth at all costs. And I think that was propped up by a lot of venture capital flowing into young consumer brands. In the food space, delicate landscape because so much of success past your early adopter community is going to depend on retail execution. Right? And more top of funnel marketing, which is more expensive. And there's no amount of investment capital that can compensate for how inefficient your marketing is going to become and how risky it's going to become to succeed and compete at the highest levels. So I think what I saw it was a lot of like instant gratification style of marketing investment and consumer investment. What's the biggest return on investment? I'm going to try a bunch of things. If it doesn't work, I'm going to stop. If it works, I'm going to double down. Felt like gambling almost in my previous experiences. And this time around, I think it felt a bit more strategic and rooted in the product first and foremost. Is our product the best? Is it priced appropriately? Where is it priced? How is it positioned? And then who are the first customer buckets that we're going to go after? Is it the health and wellness community? Is it the culinary community? Is it, we were just a lot more specific and targeted and chipped away at it rather than threw a bunch of darts.
Digging into that kind of the gambling analogy as you use it, a lot of those brands, they were gambling in their early days. They could do it because they were sourcing from co-packers that were domestically based. Olive oil was a little bit different. So how'd you go about sourcing the right quality olive oil and then finding the right partners to be able to launch this business?
Yeah, that was probably still the hardest part, actually. I think that it takes a lot of persistence and respect and genuine curiosity to compel people in antiquated industries to shift their thinking, right? A lot of times you can give people comfort financially and say, I'll put my money where my mouth is. I'll pre-purchase the product even before it's harvested. 8 months before a farmer goes to try to remove the crop from the trees, you already have a customer because I so believe in what I want to sell. And there was a lot of that on our end as far as we could extend ourselves. And then at the same time, I think there's always the deep-rooted knowledge. And maybe a lot of people are like 60 plus in industries like olive oil. It's not a bunch of 30-year-olds in Brooklyn running around in Andalusia or in Tuscany trying to do this. It's people that have a lot of experience. And I think they respond positively to people being inquisitive about their careers and their legacy and their practices and wanting to learn first before proliferating, in a sense. And I feel like propping up a brand in the US, quickly designed, made at a co-packer, is like all about proliferation, right? There's no actual curiosity about the practices or the machines making the product or how long they've been there and why things have been made a certain kind of way. There's a trend you're trying to capture to generate instant gratification. As an investor, I think that's fine, depending on how big the return is, but our approach was much different. Had to be.
You mentioned having pre-buy 8 months in advance. How did you balance that supply chain and that lead term with your first kind of major partners? And what was the chicken and the egg of the product, the sourcing, or the retail partner? And how'd you balance that?
Yeah, we were levered up, or we were using debt. We were tight on payroll every single month for the first 2 years. There's really no other way to look at it. Like that's where our resources were going. I think there was a little bit of, if he's doing it, I'll do it too. In a sense, you start to chip away at some people in an agricultural community and they jump on board because they see validation from someone they trust. So it was easier to expand our supply network for the quality of oil that we wanted than it was to finance it. And now, 4.5 years in, we have different financing vehicles that allow us to have a line of credit, essentially, that we can buy 100% of our inventory annually. And we have our own storage facilities. But it was difficult at the beginning. So it was like a healthy mix of being a salesperson to convince people to even do something, even if there is financial gains potentially, because that's not enough. You're not the first person to come into my backyard and tell me about all this money I'm going to make if I just work with you. You know, that's like very normal, like farmer capitalist relationship. I just plant these almonds for me. Don't worry, like I've got a customer for you. I've been there, seen that, invested and lost a bunch of money. So I think, yeah, just chipping away.
Talent is a big part of predicting the turn. And as we talk about talent, I wanted to mention one of our sponsors, Hunt Club. Imagine the power of the best marketers in the world helping you to find your next marketing leader. That's the power of Hunt Club. Hunt Club is a new category of talent company that powers the network of experts, connectors, and business leaders to help you find the best talent. Let's face it, recruiting hasn't changed with the times. Hunt Club is changing the recruiting game by leveraging technology and crowdsourced referrals to find you the best people possible for your company. Stop paying job boards that don't work or recruiting firms that recycle the same active candidates. Partner with Hunt Club.
And speaking of that chipping away, what did the retail journey look like for Graza?
Faster than we had imagined. Not to say it's smart to go into large-scale retailers early on. I think you're also still figuring out what your actual margin profile looks like. And retail flips that margin structure on its head via the use of distributors and just chargebacks and buybacks and promotion and end caps and shippers. It becomes a real estate game. Ours was fast. We were in Whole Foods 5 months into our launch. And I do think that the formula of one retailer really getting behind your product at the beginning and you putting your resources behind that retailer and advertising against that retailer and driving traffic to that retailer and showing true partnership was wise. And we definitely did that and still have a really strong relationship with Whole Foods. The strength of that relationship makes it possible to expand elsewhere without rubbing your early brand champions wrong every single time. Like there's some reality to all of this. We're trying to grow and you can't grow just in one place. But I don't know, making those investments early on was really impactful.
With that growth, when did you decide to do your first product innovation, moving beyond that core squeeze bottle, one type of olive oil?
We had to start working on it pretty fast because we had tried to patent the squeeze bottle and failed because there was a claim that we weren't in market for long enough. There wasn't a clear association between our brand and the packaging yet. Whereas like the Coca-Cola glass bottle, there's other people, no one else can use that glass bottle exactly because it's associated with Coca-Cola 100 years later or whatever it is. So we had to go pretty fast because we saw that everyone was gonna just, there's no other way to say it. Everyone else was going to copy us. So yeah, we started working on the refill cans just to be one step ahead in a sense, do another thing that no one else can do, buy machinery and retrofit it for olive oil production as opposed to beer and make it so our squeeze bottle has a life, an ecosystem that it's inside of rather than just being another squeeze bottle. So that came fast, maybe a year later. And then, now you can find our olive oil in glass bottles that look identical to our squeeze bottles and have a great pop-up spout inside. You can find us in a bag-in-box. But yeah, I wouldn't say that there's not a lot of nobility, I'd say, in expanding SKUs. It creates an operational complexity. I think it's a disservice to the consumer, actually. I think it's mostly in service of shelf space in retail, which is real.
And then when you look at that, when you did your first innovations, you were expanding within a current buyer, somebody that knew your product, it was in their shelf. When did you start thinking about collaborations, and especially collaborations that took you beyond the olive oil aisle?
Early on for us, I think for young brands, it's probably the most efficient way to capture new impression share. You give and get. What can I give and what can I get for this partnership? So early brands like us and like a Fishwife, I think we were very aware that there was probably like 50% consumer overlap between our consumer bases, but 50% wasn't. And all we had to do was collaborate or send an email to each other's audiences or do something to expose more people efficiently to each other's brands. We didn't feel competitive amongst each other. So there's the brand marketing collaboration, and then there's real product collaboration, like our collaboration with Ithaca Hummus that's become their number one SKU, outperforming other SKUs that they spent 10 years building. And so there's different type of power and investment and economics when it comes to widely retail distributed collaborations. And I guess in theory, it's all kind of a payback for investing so much in the brand development early on, like cutting those 150K, 200K checks early on to build a brand for a lot of people is so terrifying. And rightfully so, because 99% of them shit the bed. But then it's like you were going to shit the bed with a good brand or without one, probably. So you need it to stand a chance. And for us, there's continual ROI on having it. Everyone wants a piece right now. And we're in a position to say no a lot more than we say yes. Whereas early on, I was like, oh man, we're saying yes to too many things every single week and misutilizing our team's resources, I'd say.
When you think about that, the saying yes or saying no, a lot of the efforts you've done have been almost examples of ingredient brands where you're loaning your brand equity to the Ithaca Hummuses of the world, et cetera. When you go into those, how do you think about that brand equity and where you do those partnerships or where you say yes or where you say no?
Brand, it's tough. Like with just being leveraged for brand equity is not enough. It's disingenuous because like brand awareness is built over time. Even in our world with the ability to garner so much attention so quickly, it's offset by someone else also being able to do it just as quickly as you are. So real brand equity is built over time. If I wanted to license like the Harry Potter brand, like that's brand equity. You know, that's cross-generational. It's got a theme park. It's got the movies. It's got the books. It's got global reach. So I think for us, it's actually a lot about the product and the quality of the oil. And this is a category that is loosely connected to olive oil. That makes sense. Is olive oil a main input ingredient here? And are we facilitating a different flavor profile, a better flavor profile, a healthier flavor profile? Are we checking a lot of boxes rather than just pimping out our brand? Because if you do that with a young, nascent brand, you're going to probably stumble at some point and kneecap yourself from being able to do it when you really can cash in on your brand equity. If we do it too much right now and 3 out of 5 don't work, well, the big fish that was coming in 5 years isn't going to come anymore.
You mentioned earlier that when you were launching Graza, it was coming off a time period where a lot of brands were spending a lot of money really fast trying to proliferate where they could. You took a more approach of thinking about it and driving through. When you talk to entrepreneurs that are trying to launch a brand today, what advice do you give them of what you think the brand building world is going to look like for a new business in the next 5 years?
If I see anyone that's pigeonholed to one potential customer, I run the other way. I think that even in the health and wellness space, you look at a brand like Athletic Greens, they so nailed it in terms of brand positioning. And just 3 years later, you've got the gummies and the other green powders and the other. And I think the person that wins that space is going to be the one that is going to compel someone that would have never thought to do a greens anything ever. You know what I mean? It's all about that next consumer base being a lot harder than the first one. So I look at brands and people that can think that way and not just lean into their core consumer because that magic runs out. Same way that we need to compel people that have never even tasted extra virgin olive oil to buy Graza. It's a lot easier to say, you buy extra virgin olive oil, so buy mine, than it is to get the next consumer to join the olive oil party. So I don't know. I'll think about that when you're starting something.
Yeah. And what about the entrepreneurial journey itself? What advice do you give to founders that want to launch a new brand, want to jump in there? Boom. Talking beyond the product and what it talks to actually be the entrepreneur itself.
Difference between being an entrepreneur and leading a company. I'd say entrepreneur can get something to market and be very convincing and rally people together early on, but maybe is unaware of what it takes to lead a company. So be aware of that, be reading, be talking to people, be asking for feedback. And yeah, be sure that you're ready for it. There's a lot of sacrifice. You have to know why you're doing it. Otherwise, you'll wake up one day and feel strange about how you spend your time in your life. So, yeah, so be resetting, be asking yourself the question of why am I doing this? Or have someone that does that for you along the way. I had friends doing it for me. So it's hard. It's really hard. It's glorified in our culture, I think. The podcast world specifically is one where entrepreneurship is spoken about a lot, and it's incredibly inspiring, usually. And I think we spend enough time talking about the difficulties of it, the family dynamics that are challenged, I have kids, how much time am I spending with my kids versus with my company versus with my coworkers? So that comes back to the why you're doing it.
That's a great point. I love that. Thinking about that and as you said, the leading the company versus just being the entrepreneur, Where do you see leading the company for the next 18 to 24 months of Graza?
Yeah, I think that you're going to see Graza become a top two olive oil company. Like, we're very clear in what our goals are in our core category. I think we're in growth mode and we're orienting around people and strategies that align with the level of growth that we think we can achieve. And I think you'll see us expand into other categories. I think you'll see us not collaborate and take a stance on where we think we have a right to win, because we're doing the things that we did so well in olive oil. We are using olive oil, we're creating delicious things, we're working in categories that are highly consumable, they're habitual, they're tactile. I think we're going to follow our DNA, but do it elsewhere. So yeah, I think we've got a pretty big CPG company on our hands.
I think that is an awesome place to bring the conversation to a close, and on that big CPG company that you've got on your hands. I can't wait to see it.
Thanks, Dave. This is really fun and super reflective, and hopefully someone learned something.
For sure.
Thanks so much for listening. If you like the show, hit that rating and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And for more resources, head over to predictingtheturn.com.